All right, please turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 7. It is good to sing with the people of God. And I got to tell you, the people behind me really helped me sing a bit louder today. And it was good and glorious. And so I encourage everyone just to sing out in praise to Jesus, because it is good for the people of God to do so. Well, this is going to sound like a total change of directions, but do you like curling? I do. Well, he's from Canada, so of course. The 2026 Winter Olympic Games are set to begin in just under a month. Among the events is the exciting but not so fast-paced sport of curling. The main objective, if you didn't know, is to slide a stone slowly down the ice while grown adults sweep with brooms and grunt very loudly, trying to hit the target. The team closest to the center of that target wins. Now this morning, you might be wondering, where am I going with this? Well, this is a stretch, but go with me. This morning, we arrive at Daniel chapter 7, and our journey has been a bit like curling. We started at the end of November, and we have slowly worked our way through the first half of the book. And now, we have finally found the center. There it is. There's the connection to curling. That's all I got. Now, I mentioned at the very beginning of this book that Daniel's structure is quite unique, and I want to forewarn you, we're having a little bit of trouble with the PowerPoint this morning because of my clicker, so we're going to try to get it to work here, but I want to show you a, let's see if this works. Does this work? Oh, I don't know if this is going to work. The tension is as thick as a curling match here. There we go. All right, so the structure of Daniel is unique and it is interesting. You could divide the book by language, and I'm having a hard time with it, so you might click forward for me. You can divide it by language, where chapters 2 through 7 are in Aramaic and chapters 1 and 8 through 12 are in Hebrew. That's one way you could divide the book. You could divide it also by literature. Narrative is in verses, or rather chapters 1 through 6, and then apocalyptic literature is in chapters 8 through, or rather 7 through 12. Now, you might not be able to see it from this chart, but this actually points to the center of the book being chapter 7. And I want to show you that visually. So you have here all of the chapters of the book. And if we are to note that the Aramaic chapters are 2 through 7, and that the apocalyptic chapters are 7 through 12. Whoops, that was my bad there. We can go back there. You can see that the very center of the book is chapter 7. Chapter 7 bridges the language and the literature halves, and it's really cool. There's more we could say about it, but that's all I'll say for now. This is the author's way of shining a spotlight here on the chapter. And there's no surprise that in this chapter, it brings together all the major themes of the book. In it, we see that kings and kingdoms come and go, but only God's kingdom is everlasting. Now, this chapter, chapter 7, is what we call apocalyptic literature. And I think we're going too far ahead. Just go to the blank if you could. There we go. It is apocalyptic literature. Now, we get that term, apocalypse, from the first word in the book of Revelation, because it simply means revelation. But it's become to be known as a type of literature that's defined by intense metaphorical and symbolic imagery. Apocalyptic is symbolic in that its intense imagery symbolizes something. And it's metaphorical in that we're given figures of speech that are meant to convey emotion and gravitas. Now, given that fact, we must be careful not to be too precise in our interpretation of apocalyptic literature. The imagery is there to make us feel something. And so by doing, we can better understand what's really going on. Take, for example, the well-known imagery of the Twin Towers falling down on 9/11. If you watch the footage even 20-plus years later, it will elicit emotion for those of us who remember it. And it helps us remember the gravity of that day. Apocalyptic prophecy is just like that. But it will do more than just elicit alarm and concern. It's also meant to elicit hope. Because apocalyptic prophecy is about the ultimate salvation of the righteous. So if you are a Christian, an appropriate response to apocalyptic is feelings of great hope and confidence that our God reigns. Now, as we approach chapter 7, if you're a note taker, I want to give you a framework to help us work our way through it. So for the note takers, we'll first look at what beasts do. Next, we'll see what God has done. And finally, thirdly, what Christians get. Three things. Here they are again. What beasts do, what God has done, and what Christians get. Now, I don't want to say too much more about this chapter without us getting to the text. So let's dive in. Would you follow as I read Daniel chapter 7, verses 1 through 8? In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it and had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things." Now, as we begin today, you may notice we've actually jumped backward in time. We last left off with Darius, the Medo-Persian king in charge. He had just sacked Babylon, removing the Babylonians from power and their king, King Belshazzar. But now, at the beginning of chapter 7, we're back in Belshazzar's first year of reign. We'll also notice that what's before us is a strange dream, a very strange dream given to Daniel. Now, this is no holiday by the sea. This is a horror by the shore. Daniel looks out and sees a great sea stirred up by winds coming from every direction. He sees these 4 grotesque, ugly beasts rise out of the water. It's frightening, and they're described metaphorically. Remember, this is metaphor. The fourth is like a lion with eagle. Or sorry, the first is like a lion with eagle's wings. It's not actually a lion. It doesn't actually have eagle's wings. It's like a lion. You notice that word there. That's actually a key word to help us understand here. It's like a lion. And then the second is like a bear. And then the third is like a leopard. They're not actually these animals. That's the best words that we have to describe what he saw. But then you get to the fourth beast, and it's beyond words. There's no like. It isn't described like an animal of any kind that we would understand. It's so grotesque that Daniel remarks that it's terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It has many horns that represents its strength and its power. And then one horn, even a little horn, it has the eyes of a man and a mouth like a man. You see, apocalyptic is metaphorical, but it's also symbolic. And these beasts are symbolic. They mean something. They represent something. Later on in the chapter, in verse 17, we are told that these four beasts represent kings and kingdoms. Now, this actually reminds us of chapter 2. I'm going to see if I can do this by myself. That did not work. Mark, could you help me out? There you go. Chapter 2 and 7, we saw this last week, are parallel. In fact, the whole Aramaic section parallels each other. Now, both 2 and 4, it's a dream about four different kingdoms. And from our place in history, it's easy to see just who these kings and kingdoms were. The first is Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon, the lion. And that makes sense when we remember that Nebuchadnezzar was humbled and he was made into a beast with his mind. His hair grew long, and as it says in chapter 4, as long as the eagle's wings. However, after his time, his mind is restored, his hair is cut, and he continues to rule. The next beast, the bear, is the Medo-Persian Empire, then followed by the leopard, which is the kingdom of ancient Greece, followed finally by the fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire. Now, I will say that there is another competing view to what I just described to you. What I just described is called the Roman view because it ends with the last kingdom being Rome. The other view is called the Greek view, because it ends with, anyone want to take a guess? Greece. That's, you got it. See, you know this. So that would, from the Greek view, that would make the kingdoms Babylon, Media, Persia, they're divided, and then finally Greece. Now, the Roman view, what I told you and I believe is true, is the historical view. The Greek view is more recent in interpretive history. When you look at all the details, neither view is perfect. But we need to remember, apocalyptic literature is metaphorical symbolism. So let's not be too rigid about the specific interpretation here. Nevertheless, the Roman view does account for the most biblical data with the fewest amount of problems. You can go to the blank slide now. However, the big idea is not necessarily who these kingdoms are. The big idea is what these kingdoms do. These kingdoms are in opposition to God. They are evil kingdoms, led by evil kings, carrying out evil against God, his people, and the entire world. Now, this fact of their evilness and going to war against God and his people, we will see this more as we move throughout the chapter, but you can see a sliver of it in verse 8. The fourth beast had a mouth that spoke great things, pompous, arrogant things against God and his people. These beastly kingdoms represented four specific kingdoms, but in a way, they represent any beastly kingdom that's opposed to God and his people. And hear me on this. Every kingdom is a beastly kingdom. There is only one kingdom for God and his people, and that's God's kingdom. Now, I think we get this intuitively. See, when we look out at the world, we see turmoil and fear run rampant because of the beastly kingdoms among us. Just on Friday night, ironically, I happened to be listening to a professor talk about research that he's done, even in the Portland area. noting that nearly everyone's experiences the same fear because of what's going on in our world today. Chaos and injustice reign in many cities in America. We've seen it amp up just this week in Minneapolis. We've also seen evil with Iran, which has begun carrying out unspeakable and widespread murder of its own people. And of course, we've seen it for years now with Russia as it continues to wage an unjust war against Ukraine. I was in contact with our missionary to Ukraine, Mark Mieland, just earlier this week. He spoke about how his city, Lviv, was just hit by another missile attack, but they were managed to get their kids into the bunker in time. You know, if we're not careful and we look out at the world, at these beastly kingdoms, we will look out and see what's before us in despair. We will, if we're not careful, end up lost and tossed by waves of fear like a boat at sea without a motor. But as we've seen in the verses right here before us, beastly kingdoms come and go. One comes after another. And what we experience today, if the Lord tarries, will not be the same evil tomorrow. Old Testament scholar Tremper Longman put it succinctly when he said, quote, "Evil may seem as if it has the upper hand, but that is a temporary deception." And that means there's great hope for us who believe in the temporal nature of the present evil, because this evil won't last. And God does win. And suffering is only temporary. And salvation is eternal. So an honest question for you. How do you perceive the beastly kingdoms of this world? How do you respond to their evil? For the Christian, our hope is not wrapped up in how bad or how good it seems. The Christian receives hope from what God has already done. And that's verses 9 through 14. Follow as I read. "As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and his hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened." Now, I have a friend who loves telling stories, and quite frankly, he's really good at telling them. He's a quick-witted, a good-natured guy who can find the honest humor in any situation. And it'll be your judgment to figure out if this is honest humor, but anytime he told a story involving someone that was older than him, he would always refer to them as Ancient of Days. And the first time he said it, it took me a second to realize what he was saying, and it was really funny. But then he kept saying it, and I got to be honest, it's funny every single time he says it. I love it. It never got old. Now, he got that phrase from here, verse 9, where it describes God as the Ancient of Days. But does that mean then that God is an old man with more wrinkles than a prune? Well, no, not quite. That's not what that means. God is spirit, and God the Father doesn't have a physical form. And yet, here, he is described metaphorically. He's ancient. His hair and his clothes are white. His throne is made of fire. It describes his glorious nature, and it probably speaks to his eternality, his wisdom, his purity, his just judgment. So it's right then that countless of numbers stand around him to serve and worship him all around. But you know what's also all around him? Fire. His throne is made of fire. Streams of fire come out from before him. It is a magnificent and frankly intimidating scene. Now, biblically, fire can refer to one of two things. Fire can refer to purity, as in a refiner's fire that purifies a metal. Or it can mean judgment. And that's what we have here, because the judge is now in session. He enters in, he sits down, or rather the people stand, he sits down, and then the judgment begins. We see it at the end of verse 10. You can see it right there, that last line. The court sat in judgment and the books were opened. Now, in God's courtroom, no prosecution is needed, and neither is a defense needed, because God has all the evidence that he needs. He has the books. Scripture tells us elsewhere that the books are filled with what everyone has done, either good or bad. And judgment is delivered according to the books, with what we've done, good or bad. That might sound scary, and it can be, but for the Christian, actually, we don't have to fear what we've done, because we get to rest in what Jesus has accomplished. Through belief in Jesus, we know that he has canceled our record of debt, and then he set it aside, and then he nailed it to the cross. See, the good news is that by belief, we are saved. But as for the beasts, well, they don't believe. They are opposed. Opposed to God and opposed to his saints. Salvation is not possible for them. There's only one option, and that's judgment. Verses 11 and 12. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. This fourth beast, he is boasting with his little horn great things in defiance of God. His pompous words are his last words, because he is summarily destroyed by God's burning judgment. Now, the other beasts, as we're told in verse 12, for reasons unknown to us, they escape with their lives for a time. But still, their power and authority are likewise taken away. You know, if we're not careful, we could just gloss over verses 11 and 12 and really fail to appreciate the greatness and power of our God. Judgment here in verses 11 and 12 are handed down without pomp or circumstance. It's kind of like when you get your car inspected at DEQ. If it fails emissions, you aren't given a lollipop and a kind word. You are given something called, quote, a fail form. That's what it's called. I looked it up. A fail form. That sounds bad. And then you're told you have to fix it. Here, the beasts are stripped from their power, and they offer no resistance whatsoever. And therein lies the great power of God. It reads like a nothing burger, because indeed it was a nothing burger to God. He didn't strain. The battle wasn't a close call. It was a royal romping, a blowout victory. God spoke, fire came forth, and it was over. You see, the beast thought they had dominion, but they were wrong. The Ancient of Days had it the entire time. Verses 13 through 14. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Now, what you have here is what we call a peaceful transfer of power. Now, I want you to follow the imagery. This is important. We are in God's throne room in heaven. The Ancient of Days is on the throne, and he is glorious. And then this Son of Man comes. He's riding on the clouds, and he's presented before the Ancient of Days. And then the Ancient of Days gives this Son of Man all dominion. So, like, whose dominion is it that he gives him? Well, it's the dominion the beast thought they had. The dominion that actually the Ancient of Days always had. Dominion that he now shares with the Son. Okay, so this begs the question. Who is this Son of Man? And from where did he come from? I mean, he has to come from somewhere, right? He came from somewhere. He rode on the clouds, and then he ended up in the throne room in heaven. Now, if you're familiar with the New Testament, then you know that Jesus is the Son of Man. He called himself these very words often. And we know that after Jesus' death and resurrection, he ascended into heaven on the clouds. And then he sat down on the throne in heaven. I want you to consider the following verses. If you could, Mark, the next slide here. The first one is Acts chapter 1, verse 9. It's 40 days after the resurrection. And it says, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. Also consider Philippians chapter 2, the next slide. Being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. Next slide. So that the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Do you see how incredible this is? Now, I want you to notice the flow of chapter 7. Death to the beast, then dominion to the Son of Man. So first, victory over Satan, sin, and death, and then all authority to King Jesus. Now, I want you to think back for a moment to right before the cross, when Jesus was on trial. He stood before the Jewish high priest, and the Jewish high priest questioned him. And in that moment, Jesus chose to refer to Daniel 7. Here it is, Mark 14. The high priest asked him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Now, some people believe that Jesus is referring to his second coming at the end of time. But given the fact that he's about to be victorious, offer his judgment over Satan, sin, and death, it's more likely that Jesus means that he's about to go into heaven and sit down at the right hand of a power with all authority, just as Daniel 7 says. And boy, does Jesus have power and authority. Check it out. Chapter 7, verse 14. He has dominion and glory and kingdom. All peoples, all nations, all languages serve him, and his dominion is everlasting. Now, I've just got to point out the fact, and if you've been with us, you'll remember this, that this is the same wording that the pagan kings of this book wrote in their global decrees. Do you remember Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4? And then Darius in chapter 6? Both of them made their public global decrees to all peoples, nations, languages, that all people would serve the living God because his dominion is everlasting. Do you realize what this means? It means that Nebuchadnezzar and Darius were writing about the Son of Man. They were writing about Christ the King. But do you even know what's even more incredible? It means that this has already happened. The Son of Man has already taken the throne. It means Satan, sin, and death have already been defeated. The beast defeated. It's done. This is not something that we hope for. This is something we celebrate now. We don't wonder if this is going to happen. We put our hope and our confidence in it right now because Jesus has won and he is on the throne right now, reigning and ruling. Friends, do you realize just how great Jesus is? Jesus won't be made great. He already is great. Now, at the end of time, Daniel 7 will be fulfilled physically. Right? He's going to come back. There's another beast. He's going to destroy it. His physical kingdom will be set up. But let us not forget that this has already happened. He has already set up his spiritual kingdom. Daniel 7 has been completed. It really happened. It really exists. And that gives us tremendous confidence. You see, Christians have it really good. We have something that Daniel never did. He got this great dream, but you know what we have? We have the reality. He longed for the day when the Son of Man would sit down on the throne. And you and I, if we believe in Jesus, we have the Son of Man, and he is on the throne, and he reigns and rules, and we serve him right now. So do you see Jesus as a distant figure who will someday achieve victory? Or do you view him as the king who has already won? See, if he is the king that has already won, that massively changes how we view the evil kingdoms of our day. Let us remember who he presently is, not will he will be, who he is. Let us serve him today. Because his kingly blessings aren't just in our future. They are available right now. And that's what we read next in verses 15 through 28. As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all of this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of the things. These four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever. That's a lot of evers. Then I remember that, how many evers that is. Then I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured in broken pieces and stamped out what was left. And about the 10 horns that were on his head, the other horn that came up, and before which 3 of them fell, the horn that had eyes and the mouth that spoke great things, and that seemed greater than his companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth which shall be different from all the kingdoms. And it shall devour the whole earth and trample it and break it into pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High and wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand for a time, times and half a time. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole earth shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here's the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed. I kept the matter in my heart. Now, there is a lot there that we just read. However, it's fairly simple, because in these verses, they simply repeat the dream that we first read, plus adding further description of what's going on. Now, Daniel, he's understandably alarmed by what he has just seen, considering these grotesque beasts. And so he wants to know more. He asks one of them next to him, likely an angel, for help to understand. The angel gives an even more detailed description of this fourth beast. He says he's very powerful. Teeth of iron, claws of bronze. It's also very destructive. It breaks others into pieces and stamps out with its feet. But the beast's reach is also very extensive in that it devours the entire earth. In verse 23, it devours the entire earth. So, what about the people of God? Are the people of God spared? Well, no. It means suffering for us. You see in verse 21 that it tells us that it makes war with the saints, and the beast prevails over them. In verse 25, we read that the beast wears out the saints, and that we, the saints, shall be given into his hand. Yes, it is metaphorical language and symbolic language, but this does mean real suffering, like hard suffering. Suffering that wears down and wears out. It's the kind of physical suffering that comes at the hand of an evil government. But it's also the spiritual suffering from the crushing guilt of sin. But I want you to notice that for the Christian, this is suffering, but it is temporary suffering. Look again at verse 25. There, the saints are given into the beast's hand, but it says, for a time, times, and half a time. Now, that could be 3.5 years, or it could be something else. We wouldn't want to be too dogmatic about it. But again, that's not the point. The point is that the suffering is limited. And that's really comforting news for the one who's suffering. Because in the middle of suffering, it's really easy to only see pain. But if we know that that suffering is limited, then we know that we can get through it because we will. And truly, the beast's time is limited because its dominion is taken from it. We read this earlier in the chapter, and now we read it again in verse 26. I'll read 26. It says, "But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end." Now, I want to pause here for a second to get our bearings, as I think this is going to be helpful. 15, verses 15 through 28, it's the interpretation, or it's the retelling of the dream. And so because it's the retelling of the dream, we already know what's going to happen. We already read this. So in verse 25, it describes that the beast makes war. And then in verse 26, we read that the Ancient of Days destroys the beast in judgment. And so in verse 27, we know what's going to happen. Remember? Death to the beast, and then dominion to the Son of Man. We know what's going to happen. But that's not what we read, is it? Check it out, verse 27. "And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole earth shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High." Dominion is given to the people of God. His saints is given to the church. In fact, this is the third time in this chapter that is mentioned. Did you notice these times? Verse 18. "But the saints of the Most High shall receive and possess the kingdom." Verse 22. "The time came when the saints possessed the kingdom." And then finally, verse 27. "And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole earth shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High." This is incredible. Because dominion is what the Son of Man is supposed to get. Dominion is what the Son of Man does get. The Son of Man is the one who defeated the beast, who defeated Satan, sin, and death. And so the Ancient of Days shares his dominion with him. And then the Son of Man, what does he do? He shares his dominion with us, those who believe. And we shall possess it. How long? Forever, forever, and ever. This is incredible. I mean, Christian, do you really realize just how good you have it? I mean, what confidence we have. What assurance is ours. What blessing we enjoy. What dominion we possess. Who are we to receive such things? How can we receive such things? It's only by God's love through Jesus Christ. Jesus said that in Luke chapter 12, verse 32. He said, "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Christian brothers and sisters, I want you to listen to that again. "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Who cares how beastly these present kingdoms really are? Who cares about what evil they do to us? They are a dime a dozen. They come, they go. They may kill us, but who cares? We possess the kingdom. Now hear me. It is not we will possess the kingdom. We presently possess the kingdom. Because the kingdom was secured through Christ's death and resurrection. And the kingdom was presented at Christ's ascension. And so therefore the kingdom is given to us by Christ's own hand. Not because of our own goodness, but because of His. Not because of your or my worthiness, but because of His. Christian, do you realize just how good you have it? All earthly kingdoms are beasts, but dominion belongs to God and His Son and His saints. What would it look like for you to believe that Jesus has truly already won? What would it look like for you to truly believe the kingdom is already yours? Would you pray with me? All praise and honor and glory be to you, O Cloud Rider. We thank you for your judgment on the beast, for conquering our sin and death, for rising in victory, for giving us your kingdom. What love we have in you, O Jesus, and I pray that you would help us realize your love, that it would hit home to us, that we would know how good we truly have it, that we would be a changed people, a changed church, that we would know you and your deep love. Lord, I pray that you would make us confident in the weeks and years to come. As evil may increase, would you increase our confidence in you even more, so that we would not be fearful people, but we would be able to proclaim confidently the good news of victory to those who do fear. Let it be us who speak these glorious words. Empower us. Lord, this church needs your help. Lord, I pray that you would fill up this church with formerly fearful people and presently confident saints who enjoy the reality of your kingdom. Do that, I pray, by your grace and your love. In Jesus' name, amen.